going to get started. So let's have a roll call, please.
Do we have anybody for roll call?
No.
Anybody. Oh, don't we?
Angela's on her way down.
So.
I will wait for
you. Oh, yeah.
Angela, we can't live without you.
Yeah.
It's good to be late a few times there. Okay.
Make us appreciate you.
Exactly.
That was like our parking. We'll
give me like a couple minutes to set this up.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and have introductions and then the roll call.
Sure. I see Laurent. Laurent Milieu will make an introduction. Okay.
Good morning, Board Chair. And board members, my name is Laurent Mallier. I am the senior engineering geologist of the North Bay section. Please welcome David Tanoe to the Water Board. David joins the North Bay section in the Toxics Cleanup Division as a scientific aide. In 2010, David graduated from UC Irvine with a BS in Earth Science, in Earth System Science. He is currently working on his MS in geology at CSU East Bay. David is working on a master's thesis focused on characterizing lead contaminations in soils. He developed a Green Lab campaign to support shifting research priorities at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab into nuclear non-proliferation and energy independence. David has started to help the section managing sites through GeoTracker. David's interest in the geological sciences is driven by his desire to understand both the natural and human processes that alter the environment. In his spare time, David enjoys hiking and playing basketball. Thank you.
Welcome. Good to have you.
And I'm thinking that's our only introduction for this month.
Yes. All right. Are we ready for the roll call?
Here.
Board Member Dunkovic.
Here.
Board Member Adjani.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger.
Here.
Board Member Muller.
Here.
Vice Chair McGrath.
Here.
Chair Young.
Here. Thank you. All right. I do not have any cards for the public forum, and Ms. Doduck could not attend today. So,
do we have any words of wisdom?
Of course we have words of wisdom.
I don't know about wisdom, but I think with what we're all going through in the seriousness of our country and our friends and family, I don't know if everyone had a chance to get the great article by Tom Seamstra Saturday in the Chronicle. I don't know if the East Bayers read the Chronicle over here. Yeah. But I think in the seriousness, I've always felt this way at times with whatevers. But the question is, can you fix stupid? And from San Francisco to Lake Tahoe, from the Sierra foothills to Mount Shasta, stupid syndrome is bringing California down, and it's about trash. And it's just quite an interesting article. Tom's a great writer, a dear friend of all of us in the environment. But boy, let me tell you, the trash, and again, on a wonderful note, the whales are on the coast of Half Moon Bay, and so is the trash. These guys are right up to the beach, but thousands of people are coming to visit them and just making us crazy because our trash cans are overfilled and things like that. But I don't know how we could fix stupid. If we could do that, we'd be a hell of a great country again. So that's just one word of wisdom, and I have a little comment later on, too, during board members' reports.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to miss this. All right, let's go ahead with minutes, please.
We don't have anything, to my knowledge, to change in the minutes, so I recommend adoption of what it says. Okay.
Move adoption of the minutes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, the minutes pass. I once again have FedEx to thank for leaving my packet in the top of my driveway in the rain.
Where do you drizzle live? On the coast.
Okay, drizzle.
We call it drizzle on the coast.
Wet enough to.
Wet and misty.
She's up there in the redwoods.
All right, let's go ahead with board members' reports, and we can start this end. Steve?
Nothing to report.
You know me and my technology. I will find it here in a minute. Yesterday, I had the privilege to speak to a group of students from China regarding our environment and water and where you get your water and how you get your water. And so after that, they had a brainstorming, and they came up with some quick things on water. I thought I'd just read you a couple. They did 18 of them. Use less water to wash dishes. I think that was young people's thought there. Take a shower instead of taking a bath. Only one flush at a time. And then this was one that caught my attention quite a bit. Have cups at the bottom of the sink to catch water to wash dishes. Use the water you used yesterday to wash your feet. That was a good one for me. I didn't know where that came from, but I thought it was good. Build fewer fountains and make an easy water purification machine to collect water and to use to wash your hands and take a shower. So anyway, it was a great day. I tried to keep him awake. I tried to engage him. It was a little challenging, but I thought I did my Farmer John best to make him laugh when I could. But it was very special that they had the opportunity to listen and learn about water. I asked them where their water came from, and most of them, I showed them a bottle, and they agreed from a bottle.
Can I add something? Yeah. Yes, I mean, when I was in China in April, they don't drink from their tap. It's a big, big problem. They constantly drink from the bottle, and I don't even know how. I don't even trust the bottled water here. I don't know how. I would trust the bottled water anywhere else. So it's really sad.
Circling right back to trash with all the bottles of water in China. I know. This is uplifting this morning. How about this?
Well, just to add on to board member Johnny's comment, there are places in the country where you don't drink from the tap here as well, so it's not really China. But I have no report. Thank you.
You know, the chairman forgot the favorite that we all had when we were young and the first drought came along, you know, shower together.
I was wondering why that wasn't on the list.
I may be old, but I haven't forgotten.
That's you hippies.
So, well, we never showered back then anyway. I've been doing a little bit of work on looking at Measure AA implementation to kind of be sure that we're going to be as efficient as we can so that we use that money wisely and try to get some type of consolidated communication effort. So that's promising. And I've begun to work on a Berkeley bond for, among other things, public infrastructure, for green infrastructure. I would like to make Berkeley a model in implementing the green infrastructure requirements of the NPRSA, and it will take pressure on the city and the city manager and the public works director to have it go into green infrastructure rather than just pavement. But the fact that there's a big interest in it and it's popular is good. So that's all I have.
All right. I have nothing this month. I played all month. So much fun. So,
wow.
Bruce, it's you. It's yes. All to you.
A couple things. So we've hit July, which means we're into a new state fiscal year as of July 1. The budget for fiscal year 16-17 was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor in late June. That does, for us, memorialize that we will get some new positions for the site cleanup program and one position for our swamp surface water assessment and monitoring program, which is actually switching from a contract position to a full state position. So it's a step forward, and we're starting the hiring process for that. As part of the budget, there is trailer bill language, a trailer bill still in process that will increase your VAST per diem from $100 a day to $250 a day and recognize the work you do to prepare for the board meeting. So essentially say you get also a day of preparation pay. That still, that bill has not been officially passed and signed, so don't spend the money before you have it. I understand that the Senate has approved it, the Assembly has not, and they're on recess until August. So we expect when that is signed, it'll be retroactive to July 1. So we'll track that down for you. Pardon me?
Save the money to spend it later.
Yeah, there we go. In typical fashion, the trailer bill language has a whole laundry list of things. Usually these trailer bills they're to implement various aspects of the budget, and they're a whole hodgepodge of things. Usually they get signed right after the budget is signed. In this case, I guess there's enough back and forth that it'll trickle in a little bit late. But to my knowledge, there's nothing additional in that trailer bill language that actually speaks to the regions. There are some aspects of the drinking water program that are touched on in there, but not specific to us. So I'll keep you posted if there's any changes on that. I just also wanted to highlight in the executive officer's report this month the number of sites we have issued site cleanup orders on or rescinded orders. As I've noted before, that we're using our water code authority to under section 13304 to issue or rescind cleanup and abatement orders, which is something I can sign. And so my approach is to have staff put these out for public comment. Essentially, if we get no comment or minimal comment, I'll go ahead and sign them. More significant items, such as the one we have on today's agenda, we like to bring to you. I know this was as part of the questionnaire circulated to our members still going through the confirmation process. This was a question on the questionnaire as to how does the board plug into the cleanup program, and this is one way of trying to ensure that when we have a significant site, we'll bring it to you. When it's less significant, we'll report on where we are, but certainly I always look forward to any thoughts and comments you have as you read through this. But it's also a positive that in a number of cases here, we've been able to actually close some sites, some I remember working on 25 years or more ago. So it's nice to finally be able to say we're closing things. So with that, I'll stop right there.
All right, do we have questions?
Bruce, I have two questions. One is simple, so I'll ask that one first, and one's maybe a little bit more complicated. I really appreciate the list of pending policy matters at the State Board that helps me keep track. I noted the one for procedures for discharges of dredge or fill material to the waters of the state, which is coming up pretty quick in October. I want to make sure that that's being coordinated with the efforts that BCDC is doing and doesn't preclude our interest where appropriate in horizontal levees.
Right. We've been tracking that closely and making sure that there's enough flexibility in that language that we will be able to use that to support projects that will address shoreline resiliency, sea level rise, and the horizontal levee, or there's becoming a variety of names of habitat slope and all these terms that are coming out as part of that.
And for the public that may not recognize, sometimes we think we're better off with a gradual subsurface slope, which breaks wave energy rather than armoring all of the shoreline. but it's not one size fits all. It has to be looked at carefully. So the second question has to do with the Caltrans MS-4 pending. I want to make sure that that doesn't preclude additional action in this region if necessary. We, as we have talked about before, want to galvanize a leadership position out of Caltrans rather than a trailership position. So can you talk about that?
Right. The emphasis here is to update this to include identifying those waters that Caltrans may be working in or around that are subject to TMDLs, and to make sure that that's spelled out. So all the regions have provided a list of TMDLs that could be affected through Caltrans work, including those waters we have identified as impacted for trash. And so this is potentially a nexus for us to work with Caltrans to try to align the work they'll be doing with the municipalities. At the same time, as you note, we've had some back and forth already with District 4, the local Caltrans district, and have a good working relationship with them. The challenge is sometimes that they get direction out of Sacramento that may be a little different, and so we're trying to make sure that this permit reflects what the regions are doing and what the regional needs are moving forward.
Oh, that's so what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
I actually had a question on the same topic. I also want to make sure that whatever is coming out of this state board effort does not in any way conflict with our timeline that we have put the cities on, and we've also said that we were going to put Caltrans and the other dischargers on for trash.
Right. This is aligned with the state's trash policy, which isn't 100% reflective of ours, but is close. And so we want to, in our region, align these efforts and use this as a way to push Caltrans forward.
Okay. Well, I would ask that you continue to, and the staff continue to keep a close eye on both of these issues. As I recall, the statewide trash policy set a 10-year timeline, which actually
correct.
We're already in our 10 years, so
right.
I don't want
right.
Caltrans to get the wrong idea about our timeline. I'm looking at Keith, and he's looking at me, and we're nodding our heads.
Yeah.
So.
And also,
stay on top of that.
Relative to the dredge and fill policy, we'll provide you some more specifics on that either next month or the following month. We have had a lot of input on that, and we're much more comfortable with where it is. As you note, they've had some workshops. They're going to hear this at the I think it's next week's state board meeting as a workshop, but plan adoption of it in October. It is set up to be a policy, and it essentially then would be a policy that would be incorporated into the Inland Waters Plan and be a statewide plan that would become part of our basin plan. So it would supersede our existing requirements, but it's consistent from what we can tell with our existing requirements, and to a certain degree may provide that flexibility, as I noted earlier, for addressing shoreline resiliency and sea level rise that wasn't contemplated back when our policies in the 80s were put into the basin plan.
I just have a quick question about the integrated report adoption. You tell me how was that report used? What's the audience for that report? I was grilled about that during my confirmation process, and I, just pleaded ignorance. And
so you're not going to tell us what the integrated report is part of the effort under Federal Clean Water Act for us to study all waters, identify where those waters may not be achieving water quality standards, and then ultimately for those waters that are listed as not achieving, identify those that need to have TMDL, total maximum daily load, put in. It's written in small print, I would say, that each state is supposed to update its list every 2 years. That's become a challenge in California. We've fallen behind. And so with EPA's agreement, The state went to a process of having three regions every 2 years and parse it out. The first of the three, and this report says, the 2014 integrated report, we're still working on the 2014 report for the first three regions. So they said, gee, we're already falling behind then on the 2016 and 2018, so let's just lump the other six into essentially a 2016/18, and we're in that second group. We feel we have adequate information to plug in fact, all the work you've been doing, including considering delisting. We're trying to see how that gets plugged in. So this is a report that is a public report, basically identifying, based on what's supposed to be the latest information on each water body, what is the current status of all of our region's waters, and of those that aren't achieving, what are we going to do about it, essentially. And so it is a public report that we rely upon. We have started, and in fact, we'll be bringing back to you a little bit after the first of the year what we will be sending to State Board to be part of the integrated report. It's another one of these processes that the regions report to State Board. State Board adopts a statewide listing. EPA then gets a chance to review, and in some cases, EPA makes changes to the list. So we'll keep you posted as this moves forward. We feel we're essentially up to date and ready to move, but it's been a lengthy process elsewhere in the state.
I had the same question in my confirmation hearings. The audience seems to be the legislature and environmental groups. That's good. Good to have an audience.
See what you learned through your hearings. These folks learned a lot about the water conservation regulation.
Inside joke. Yeah. All right. Other questions on the executive officer's reports? All right, then. We will go ahead, and at this point, I do need to read the swearing in. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hands. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Thank you.
The uncontested calendar has three items. We do have a supplemental for item 5A for Napa Sanitation District's reissuance of NPDES permit. I think that's before you. There are two relatively minor changes to the fact sheet that we would like to make to clarify some of the information there. I understand you have two cards for people who would like to speak in support of 5B and 5C, and so I'd suggest we could go ahead and hear those now, and then I can make a recommendation.
All right, very good. And I would like to make a further suggestion that we act on items 5A and 5B first, and then take item 5C separately. I'm going to recuse from item 5C, so that's the reason for doing them separately. So item 5A, I don't have a card for item 5A, but for item 5B, we have Pamela Lung from the city of Livermore. Welcome.
good morning, Regional Board Chair and members of the board. My name is Pamela Lung, and I represent the City of Livermore. And on behalf of the City of Livermore, I wanted to thank the staff of the Regional Board, Brian Wines, Dale Boyer, and Keith Lichten, for helping us process this permit and get to this being on the board today, and for all the hard work it's taken to review our stream maintenance program. We believe this is a great program to get all of our staff on the same board and the same page and meet the regional board's objectives, so, and meeting our objectives in the streamlining of the permit process. So I appreciate the staff's help with all of that and the regional board as well. I'm in support of the item, and if there's any questions, I'm available to answer them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So if we want to consider 5A and 5B and then 5C, I recommend adoption of 5A and 5B with the supplemental for 5A that you have before you.
All right. I'll take a motion, and then we'll do questions and comments.
A second.
All right. So questions.
I do have a comment on well, I have a comment on 5A and 5B. I'll give the good news first. To the City of Livermore, to the staff, and to their consultants, this is just excellent work. I mean, I read a tremendous amount of that report. The approach is solid. The underlying science is good. The metrics that are used to make sure, I mean, that's, I'd love to see things like that. I really love to see them on the uncontested calendar, and I thank you. But I'm not always kind. So on 5A, there's good news and there's slightly troubling news. The really good news is it's a very well-run sewage treatment plant. This will increase the rate of reuse, and it will decrease mass emissions to the river, and those are all good things. I'm a little bit troubled by the collection system rehabilitation rate. I read 1% per year, and I said my gut reaction was I'd like to see a higher rate of rehabilitation when I have a system that's much higher than other ones. And I think we're all a little sensitive here to what happened in southern Marin County, where problems went unaddressed until they became severe. I did read the response, the city's comments on the rate, and it alleviated some of my concerns, but not all of my concerns. I do recognize that not all sewer overflows are equally serious. But what I didn't see in this, and I don't think it goes to whether or not the changes in the discharge are appropriate, but I think it goes into continuing level of scrutiny, is whether or not the process of 1% a year is identifying in the first couple years those things which contribute the most. I'm skeptical, but willing to be convinced. So that's, I guess, my concern.
I think the chair had a similar concern.
Yes, the chair is about to state her similar concern.
And that's why you see representative from Napa before you to provide some input. So.
All right. We would welcome additional information if you'd like to.
Madam Chair, members of the board, I appreciate the comment, and excuse me, I agree. Napa Sanitation.
Tim.
I'm sorry. My name is Tim Healy. I'm the general manager for the Napa Sanitation District. I'm also the district's engineer.
If you would please confirm that you took the oath.
I confirm the oath. Thank you. We have the goal in the past has been to get up to 1% of sewer rehab rehabilitation in our collection system, and that's what we've been working on. Our budget actually over the next 3 years, we have approximately 1.3% in our budget to increase rehab and rehabilitation over the next 3 years. The other part of the story that wasn't completely told here is that we just finished a very aggressive a campaign changing our rate structure. And the goal was budgeting at approximately 1% a year or fixing 1%, so about $3 million a year. The goal at the end of the five-year period of this next 5 years is to be up to 2% per year. So we actually have gone through a program where we're raising our rates, 218 hearing, approximately 50% over the next 5 years, with the goal of going from 1% up to 2% for rehab and rehabilitation or I&I projects, all with the goal of getting ultimately less water in the system.
All right, thank you. Questions? I appreciate that. I did have the same concern as the vice chair, and appreciate your efforts to increase the budget, increase the rate at which you're addressing the problem. All the same, you have a ways to go, so we will be watching, hopefully with great enthusiasm, the rates of SSOs going down, but we will be keeping an eye on it. So thank you for your efforts and your continuing efforts.
We'd like to let the board know that we take care of the lower laterals. So a lot of the overflows that you see coming out of our sewer system are 1 gallon, 2 gallon, less than 5 gallon overflows that are coming up out of the clean out. A lot of times you show up at an overflow, there's no sign of any water, maybe a little bit of tissue around the clean out. And so we report every single spill that we have, whether we see them actually spilling or not. That's why a lot of these overflows are very small. They never leave the homeowner's property. But we report those anyway, so they're part of our CWICS data. And we're one of the few agencies really in the Bay Area that actually maintains those lower laterals. So
yes.
That's
and that was actually clear from the information packet, and we appreciate your extra efforts to do that reporting, and certainly don't want to bang on your heads for doing better reporting than anybody else.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
For full disclosure, I'm about to replace my sewer lateral.
It's about time.
There's no way of knowing, but the foundation, it is actually not leaking, but since I've got the whole thing exposed, fix it. Another $1,000 to fix it when it's all.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah. So, I do think we want to pay attention and urge the staff to make sure that you're addressing the highest priority, because at that point, 2% per year might be sufficient to really significantly reduce that.
And as the fact sheet noted, we did an audit of Napa's collection system operations in fall of 2014, and we're sort of cycling through the agencies, and we'll return to them in a couple of years to do that full audit.
All right.
All right. I also wanted to echo the vice chair and congratulate our staff in the city of Livermore for putting together the stream maintenance program. It's really impressive. I hope that as other people follow in your footsteps, they can use at least many parts of this as a template going forward, and hopefully both you at the city as well as we will find that the initial efforts that you put into creating the stream maintenance program are returned back to you many times in terms of the increases in efficiency in your operations, and we hope that's the result. If it's not, please let us know, and we'll, you know, figure out how to do things better. But I'm encouraged by the fact that we have had other stream maintenance programs that come back after 5 years with minor changes, and they just kind of run right through. So in some
ways,
it's a five-year program on the way to a 10-year program. So thank you for your efforts in putting in the efforts before we get to the permitting stage. All right. I think we are ready for a roll call vote then on items 5A and 5B.
Board Member Obu?
Aye.
Board Member Lefkowitz?
Aye.
Board Member Ajami?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Board Member Mueller?
Aye.
Vice Chair McGrath?
Aye.
Aye. All right, 5A and 5C pass, and I am going to 5A and 5B pass. I'm going to turn over 5C. I'm going to recuse from 5C and turn over the workings of the chair to our vice chair.
And Chair Young, if you could please confirm for the record that the recusal is based upon an appearance of bias.
The recusal is based solely on any potential appearance of conflict, because there is an attorney who has been involved in this who is in my husband's law firm, and I don't want anybody to ask any questions.
I appreciate the scrupulousness nature of recusal, even if there's no direct conflict.
Right.
So item 5C is adoption of final site cleanup requirements for the what we call the formerly Rome Planck site, or now Starlink Logistics, in East Palo Alto. As you'll note from the item, this has had extensive regulatory history over the last 30, 35 years. And the effort here is, while most of the cleanup work has been done, this consolidates all of the regulatory actions into one action. And so this then becomes the one, essentially the Bible for, to use for oversight of this site, its various operable units moving forward. So I understand you have a card, and Buzz, were you going to speak or just be available?
So I do have a call. Robert Hines, I assume?
Yes. Otherwise known as Buzz. Robert Hines from the law firm Farrell, Braun & Martell in San Francisco. I have taken the oath. And I just wanted to speak in support of and be available to respond to any questions concerning the tentative order. And like the city of Livermore, I wanted to thank staff profusely, Mark Johnson and Cheryl Prowl have really done yeoman's work to, as Mr. Wolf said, to consolidate several orders over a very, very long period of time to really make the framework for future work a lot more clear as things continue to happen down in East Palo Alto. I also wanted to thank my colleagues at SS Papadopoulos, which is Starlink Logistics consultant firm, Mike Rafferty and Kinsley Bernard, who also worked very extensively with board staff to come up with this consolidated order. So I have no further comments, and thank you for letting me appear.
Are there any questions?
No question. Just I don't need to speak, or just a comment. You know, going back in history, I don't think I have to recuse, but great-grandpa used some of these amazing, horrible materials that killed a lot of bugs in those days. And but we've been involved in this thing for a lot of years at this board, and I think this is a real tribute, as the speaker just said, to get this thing where it is today. So thank you.
With no further comments, can I have a motion for approval of what? We have a recommendation.
I recommend adoption of the revised tentative order.
So can I have a motion?
I so move on item 5C.
I'll second that.
I think we're ready for a roll call. Angela?
Board Member Ogu?
Aye.
Board Member
Leskovich?
Aye.
Board Member Adami?
Aye.
Board Member
Kissinger? Aye.
Board Member Mueller?
Aye.
Vice Chair McGrath?
Aye. That brings us to the end of item 5, and the next item is item 6, and we can bring the boss back.
Yeah. So item 6 is information item on our environmental risk assessment efforts for site cleanup programs. I'd like Nicole Fry to make the presentation.
Left behind and
Good morning, Chair and Board. I'm Nicole Fry, and I'm in the Toxic Cleanup Division. And I'm going to give you guys an overview on how we assess risk in our groundwater cleanup program. Let me turn down the lights a little. All right, I'll start with an overview for the talk. I'm going to start with a general overview of our site cleanup process and give you a sense of where the risk assessment piece fits. And then I'll get into the key elements of how we assess risk. And then once we have the key elements, I'll try to plug them into this case study to give you a clearer sense of how we actually assess risk at the sites. So this, I'm going to walk you through a flow chart of our site cleanup process. So initially, a site is identified where a toxic release has occurred, and then we open a case and do an initial site investigation. And here we're collecting information to get a clear picture of where the contamination is, what type of contamination, and get any information about characteristics at the site that are that would be important. And then once we have all of this information, we can then do a risk assessment to see what risk the contamination at the site poses. If we find that current risk of exposure is unacceptable, then we would require an interim risk management. So this would mitigate any risk that we have at the site until we're able to then come up with a cleanup plan and then implement that plan and do the cleanup. Lastly, we would like to then make sure that the closure criteria has been met. And then we would close the site, ending the process. So you can see here that the risk assessment, it helps us to decide when a risk is occurring and to take action quickly. It also helps us to prioritize which cases are more risk, and so we should allot more time to them. Now I'm going to get into the key elements of how we assess risk. This diagram kind of gives you a good overview of how we decide if a risk actually is occurring at a site. So for a risk to occur, you have to have a toxic chemical present, but you also have to have a way for that chemical to come into contact with someone on the site. So an exposure needs to occur. And when we're trying to quantify the actual amount of risk at the site, we think about things like how toxic is that chemical that's present, and how much of it is there. In terms of exposure, we want to think about who is actually getting exposed and how are they getting exposed. And once we've answered these questions, we then can come up with specific values for the toxicity and the amount of exposure to quantify the risk from contamination at the site. And once we know how much risk is at the site, the next question that we generally ask is, what areas of contamination at the site could pose an unacceptable risk? And to answer this question, we turn to screening levels. So these are levels that give a concentration amount that should pose minimal risk. And so these are a quick tool to help us assess what parts of the site might be impacted. So to calculate these, we take these three different criteria, so the toxicity of the chemical we're interested in, the exposure that's actually happening at the site, who's getting exposed, how, and then also we want to think about what is the acceptable level of risk that we are trying to protect to. And so for human health exposure, we typically think about a 1 in a million chance of developing cancer, as well as no harmful non-cancer health effects from exposure to the chemical. And then these all combine to give us a screening level. Here in Region 2, we've developed the environmental screening levels. And these are screening levels that we've developed based on common generic exposure scenarios that are applicable at many of our sites. And so again, this gives us a quick tool to help us assess risk and really prioritize which cases we're working on more diligently, as well as where in the site the highest risk is. So for each of these screening levels, we develop them for specific receptors. We think about both human as well as ecological receptors. For humans, we always want to consider any highly susceptible receptors such as children, because they can be more susceptible to toxic chemicals compared to adults. For the ecological receptors, we consider both terrestrial land animals as well as aquatic. We specify whether it is a saltwater environment versus a freshwater, since they can have different susceptibilities to toxicity. Now that we know what receptors we're trying to protect, I'm going to walk you through how contamination gets transported through a site and into areas where an exposure could occur. So here I'm showing a cross-section where you can see the soil in brown and groundwater. So we have a release, and this then contaminates the soil. The first question is, a person using the site, how could they get exposed to the soil? We mainly think about shallow soil because that is where an exposure could occur. That's what's accessible to the receptor. And so the three different exposure pathways that we look at are dermal, touching contaminated soil, ingesting contaminated soil, as well as inhaling dust particles. The next transport pathway is leaching. So when we have a high enough contamination in the soil, it can get down into groundwater. And as you can see, the groundwater contamination moves in the flow direction of the groundwater, creating a groundwater plume. Looking at what exposure could occur, typically this happens, exposure occurs when there is a groundwater well providing access to the groundwater. And we think about the dermal exposure pathway, ingestion or drinking of contaminated water, as well as inhaling water vapors. Next, we want to think about volatilization. So both contamination in the groundwater as well as in the soil contamination can volatilize and then contaminate the soil gas. Thinking about exposure to receptors, we typically look at vapor intrusion pathway. So contaminated soils can migrate up into a building, contaminating indoor air, and then we can get inhalation exposure. The last pathway we consider is discharge of groundwater to surface water. And here we're worried about both human receptors as well as aquatic receptors. And the pathways we consider, again, similar to groundwater, are dermal ingestion as well as vapor inhalation. So now that we have the key elements of the risk assessment, I'm just going to walk you through this case study. So I chose a dry cleaner case study where we have tetrachloroethylene, or PCE, as the contaminant that's been released into the subsurface. This is a common dry cleaning solvent that was used at the dry cleaner. So we'll start with the site investigation, where we collect the sampling data. So samples from soil as well as groundwater are marked. And then lab results show that the PCE was detected in two of the soil samples as well as two of the groundwater. So now we have a clear picture of where the actual contamination is within the subsurface. And now we want to ask, what are the potential receptors at this site? So we have the dry cleaner workers, as well as the residents in this nearby neighborhood. And we also have the freshwater aquatic species in this nearby creek. Now, what are the current exposure concerns at this site for these receptors? So walking through each media, first, is there a current exposure from soil? And as you can see, the soil contamination is all below the building. And so in this case, we don't have accessible soil contamination. So there is no current exposure concern. For groundwater, since there are no impacted water wells, there is no current exposure. For surface water, you can see that the groundwater plume has not reached the creek, and so it's not discharging. For indoor air, we have contaminated groundwater and contaminated soil near buildings, and so volatilization could be occurring and allowing vapors to get into these buildings. So to further assess this vapor intrusion pathway, we would take more sampling data looking at the actual soil gas and indoor air. So first, looking at the residents, you can see there is a soil gas sample just above the groundwater plume. And so this will give us an idea of how much of the contamination groundwater that is actually volatilizing. And then at the dry cleaner, we have three soil gas samples just below the building. And this will give us an idea of how much vapors coming off of that soil contamination there are. And since the soil contamination is so close to the dry cleaner, we also would then take an indoor air sample at this location. And we see lab results show that PCE is detected in both the indoor air and one of the soil samples at the dry cleaner, as well as the deeper soil gas at the residence. So now we're ready to do a screening level evaluation to see if these contamination levels are above the screening level, then we'll have an unacceptable risk that should be addressed. So we decided that vapor intrusion was the main pathway, and so our screening levels will be developed based on vapor intrusion concerns. And we have two different receptors, so the screening levels will be developed for them, for the worker and for the residents. And the samples on this side will be screened against the worker, and these two will be screened against the residential screening levels. Just to give you a quick idea of why these screening levels would be different for the two different receptors, we think about workers only being exposed while they're there during the workday. So 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 250 days a year. A resident could potentially be in their home the majority of the time. And so for this exposure scenario, we think about 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 350 days a year. So now we're ready for the vapor intrusion screening level evaluation. And I will put a black dot on the samples where the screening level, the samples are below the screening level, and then a star when they're above the screening level. And so you can see that now we know that the groundwater is not a concern for vapor intrusion. Thus, there is no current risk at the residence. However, at the dry cleaner, we do see that we have soil gas and indoor air that's being contaminated. So we do have a current risk. Exposure is occurring. And so this would then become a high priority case for us. We would want to move quickly to mitigate the risk at this site. So further, in terms of thinking about the risk assessment, so we were just talking about current exposure, but we also want to think about future potential exposures. And so our groundwater basins are all designated as having either an existing or potential municipal beneficial use. And so we always want to screen to make sure that that beneficial use is protected, even if there isn't a current well. So here I'm showing that we want to account for a well that could be put in the future. And then we are going to do a screening level evaluation based on tap water. And you can see that the groundwater is above the tap water screening levels. And so when we develop our cleanup plan, we want to make sure that we are protecting for tap water use. Okay, so now let's go back through the site cleanup process. So through this case study, I've showed you how we've taken information from a site investigation and then put it into a risk assessment. And this specific example clearly shows a situation where we would need interim risk management at the dry cleaner. And then we would develop a cleanup plan. And in this cleanup plan, that's where we would set our cleanup goals for the project. So we always first want to consider cleaning up to background, returning the site to its initial conditions pre-release. However, at many of our sites, this is found to be infeasible, either technologically or economically. And so in that case, we then would set the cleanup goal at a regulatory standard. So this could be something like the maximum contamination levels for groundwater. However, there are situations where there are no regulatory standards. And for those, We would then turn to risk-based screening levels, so that were developed in the risk assessment as our final cleanup goal. When we do a cleanup, a lot of times it's not feasible to even clean up to the risk-based screening level. And so in those situations, we would then need risk management, longer-term risk management, to mitigate risks from that residual contamination that isn't able to be actively cleaned up. And so Ross Steenson of our Groundwater Protection Division will be giving you a status update later this year to give you a better sense of what type of risk management practices we require. So in general, we're hoping that with my status update on the risk assessment and then Ross's on the risk management, you should get a pretty good overview of how we deal with risk in the groundwater cleanup divisions. With that, that ends my presentation, and I'll take any questions.
All right, thank you.
Let's start at this end with questions.
Thank you for the presentation. That was really very comprehensive. I was curious if you mentioned in the summary and mentioned in your report a little bit about animal life. Can you talk a little bit about how either animal life or wildlife is factored into the assessments and whether it's just wildlife that, or if it's all animal life or just animal life that might be in the food chain? Where does that fall?
So with the environmental screening levels that we developed, we have essentially the freshwater ESL and the saltwater ESL. And so those we always consider for any type of aquatic species. For terrestrial, that is a much bigger question, as you stated, with the food chains and thinking about that. And so if we do identify species that we think are being harmed, then we will then ask for a more comprehensive environmental risk assessment to be done.
Can I add to that also? Thank you, Nicole. Stephen Hill with the Water Board. The environmental screening levels are more generic. They apply to a whole range of sites. We concluded it wasn't really feasible to have screening levels for terrestrial impacts because there's so many different critters and the impacts of the different constituents are different in each one. It's just a very large job. So those become very site-specific. The case you just voted on, Rome Palanque, had a very specific ecological risk assessment for that reason. So we do consider it when it's needed. In an urban setting, you wouldn't really need to do an eco-risk assessment, though. So that's a bit more context.
And also recognize we're talking about sites where we've had a toxic release that we're trying to figure out how clean is clean and how far do we go. We also apply risk assessments essentially to surface waters in broader instances such as the TMBLs we've adopted for mercury and PCB as to what do we need to do to reduce risk from the existing levels of mercury that are already in the bay. And that's sort of a different issue, but it to a certain degree follows the same process. But here, predominantly, as Nicole pointed out, the receptors that we're most commonly looking at are those human receptors here, periodically the ecological receptors.
Can I ask a question? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful presentation. I have a question, which is, so in your slide 20, I think, where you don't have the well in your picture, mm-hmm. I'm assuming we think that most of the risk is on the sort of the workplace rather than the residential area. But I wonder if we ever take any measures to let people in the neighborhood know that there is such a case. Because, I mean, if people want to put a well in their backyard, all they have to do is to go and pay, like, I think $200 to dig a well. And there's nobody tells them what's going on in that groundwater. So I wonder, is there Are there any precautions that we
Well, and this gets into the risk management piece that we'll talk further on next month. But certainly that's why not only are we identifying sort of the current risk, but what is the potential or future risk. So
right.
Here clearly we're wanting in this example to recognize the potential for or the need to address that indoor air vapor intrusion pathway. So that's going to drive what our cleanup of the soil is. But also we recognize that our groundwaters, even if they're not used now, could be used in the future. So then we want to evaluate what does that mean in terms of a cleanup level for the groundwater. And in many of the cases we have, we've actually been on a regional basis fairly lucky in terms of how extensive our groundwater pollution is, how much it's getting into drinking water, because in an area such as the Santa Clara Valley, where we do have a lot of wells, we actually have a shallow zone, and then there's aquitard that sort of separates from a next zone, a B zone, and actually the groundwater that's being used is taken from a C zone. So we still are trying to address cleanup of that A zone, but in many cases have found that because the chemicals we're looking at do degrade over time, the likelihood of using that A zone, it's probably not going to be used before there's been some level of degradation of that chemical. And so that comes out a little bit in the risk management, including where we would require a deed restriction on the property to say, for instance, this dry cleaner site would say, okay, moving forward, if you're going to redevelop this, either you can't put a residential use here or you need to have it written into the deed that you can't put in a well.
And I do understand, because what you are saying is mostly focusing on the location of the dry cleaner and the surrounding area. But my and I think you sort of answered that as well. My concern is if we already have a residence living around that area, and you know, we tell them stop using your groundwater for conserve water, and they want to keep their lawns going. They can, I mean, these are broad examples, but people are like start.
Right.
Getting water out of the
And actually, as part of the site investigation, we typically require an evaluation of where there are existing wells. That obviously doesn't get to future wells, but trying to identify all wells in the area, including historic wells that may not be used now but may need to be closed because some of those wells may be a conduit between the A, B, and C zone. And so we're trying to get that big picture. So we didn't go into all the details here on the site investigation, but that is a piece of the puzzle. Likewise, there's an area that we're not including in our sort of risk assessment and risk management is risk communication.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognize that's an issue. How do we make sure the community is aware of what's in their backyard, as it were? And so we typically do series of fact sheets, public meetings, deed restriction, property transfers. Typically, the folks doing those will review our GeoTracker database, which has all of this information available. We'll typically have to field calls sometimes on a property transfer to say, is this something we need to worry about or not? And so there's a lot of pieces here, and so we've maybe simplified this a little bit, but that's why, to a certain degree, you know, as we noted in the executive officer report, we're finally pleased we're closing some sites after 25 years because, you know, there's a process, but it takes time, and we want to be sufficiently conservative before we close a site, not saying that everything has to be back to background necessarily, but make sure we've identified those existing and potential pathways and have those addressed moving forward.
Yep, thank you. Looking back in history, it seems like we've done a great job cleaning up this so-called clean industry in Silicon Valley and our industry down there that we all thought was clean. To me, it seems like now we've been putting a lot more emphasis on this dry cleaning world. And my comment would be, have we done outreach with the associations of dry cleaners? handouts, workshops. Is there a potential for that to come across so they're aware of what they're dealing with? I can tell you the dry cleaners that sometimes we males don't go to them as often as we should, but because we have a spouse that does. I admit it. Ida, God bless you, because I don't even know where in hell my shirts are. But anyway.
John, the new generation. Everybody takes their own shirts.
I'm the old generation. But anyway, maybe we should be trying to look for a potential outreach there on a positive note. I mean, maybe
there have been a number of efforts, including efforts to change the chemicals that are actually used at a dry cleaning facility. And so the chemicals currently used are less toxic. What we're most concerned about are those sites that may no longer be there. And so the historic sites that typically these small dry cleaners may have been in the neighborhood. It's one thing with the large industries. We sort of have an idea where those industries either are or historically have been located. But the dry cleaners may have been into neighborhoods. And frequently when we investigate one, then we see something that may be coming on site. It may have been across the street. And so right now we've reported to you a little bit that over the past year we've ramped up using the funding source that we have through Senate Bill 445, which allows us to do some evaluation where we don't have a responsible party to pay the cost recovery. We can do some investigation, and staff is in the process of sending out and has received back a lot of information on site histories, trying to get an understanding of when there was operation there, what chemicals were used. Is there a need for us then to require that site investigation due to a release? So this is an area you're going to continue to hear from us on. Even after you're off the board, we'll continue to be reporting on this because it is sort of the next area that we had thought, as you said, you know, okay, we've addressed by and large sort of the clean industry, the semiconductor industry and their use of volatile organic chemicals. Now, the same money of the same chemicals that were cleaning solvents, degreasers, et cetera, have been used elsewhere, and we're trying to track those down.
I'm not sure I heard the answer to John's question. As to, I mean, I understand that most of the things that we're dealing with are from historic contaminations from chemicals that are no longer used, but is there an active information program for current dry cleaners? I sort of assume so because now we have a regulatory structure for them, but does anyone know the answer to that question? Stephen? Bruce?
Chair Young, I don't have a specific answer to that question. I kind of reiterate something that Bruce said a moment ago, which is we've seen a dramatic improvement in both the reduction in the quantity and the toxicity of the chemicals that are used for dry cleaning. We're on, our fifth generation of dry cleaning machines. The old ones, you'd bring out the sopping wet clothes and drag them over to the dryer and drip your solvent on the floor, and now we have closed systems and various other things that make the risk of a spill much less. So we are really dealing with a legacy program. The air districts also regulate dry cleaners because of the emissions. So this is a very heavily regulated activity. So I'm not sure that coordination with the current dry cleaners would necessarily get at the legacy aspects.
Okay. Thank you.
And there has been a lot of effort, maybe not always consistent effort, but over the last 25 years, a lot of work done. Santa Clara Valley Water District did a dry cleaner study of trying to identify where dry cleaners historically were located because they're obviously the agency concerned about the potential impact to the groundwater resource. And so we are using that as we're moving forward to investigate. We're trying to get other information that might exist elsewhere. and also in those limited instances where we have a polluted well, trying to work backwards to understand why is this well polluted, what does that mean? So there's been a long recognition that dry cleaner sites are a source, but as Stephen says, to a large degree, we're viewing them as a legacy source, that we're not getting current spills. It's from past practices, much as other industries have had historic practices where things we accepted 50 years ago, now we find have an impact. And so we're trying to work backwards to a certain degree. And this also is the effort, as we've described to you over time, of trying to prioritize our groundwater resources. Where should we be looking? Where are the resources we want to make sure are protected moving forward? Or where is there information that we need to find so that we can say this is groundwater that's safe to use?
Coming back to something you said, Bruce, that we do a risk assessment not only of groundwater sources that are being used, but also may be used in the future. I wonder, groundwater that is not potable, not because of contamination, but maybe because of salinity or other dissolved solids, do we treat those the same way, or do we not include those because there's no likelihood that those...
Well, and that's where we get back to the risk assessment, because as Nicole said, the point of departure is that all of the groundwater, in fact, it's state policy, that all groundwater is either existing or potential municipal use. But then there is written into that policy that if the yield is so low that you would never use it, or the salinity is so high that you would never use it, then it can fall out of that beneficial use. But that's more on a sort of a site-specific basis. So we do make that evaluation for each of these sites, but then that plugs into the risk equation, so that if we've already determined that the shallow groundwater is so salty, for instance, that will never use it, then in theory, there isn't an exposure from that specific pathway.
Okay, thanks.
Do we have a sense at this point how many sites that we have where the ESLs that we've developed are applicable versus how many, what percentage of sites we have to come up with site-specific levels?
I would say that we developed them to be very conservative so that they do hit a very large range. And so it really, a lot of times it depends on how much money they want to spend on a larger risk assessment to really get into what are the specific exposure scenarios at that site in order to get a more specific screening level versus just using ours, which are more conservative.
Stephen Hill, let me just also add to that while our environmental screening levels do cover the majority of the common contaminants and exposure pathways, there are some pathways that they don't cover. So, for instance, backyard gardening is not addressed in the ESLs. That's not commonly an issue, but if it is, we'll have to go beyond the ESLs to come up with protective standards.
And I think it's also worth noting that this risk-based approach that we've been essentially using for 25 years or so is actually, we were really the agency pushing this, because historically in the 80s, where the issue of as John notes, when the clean industry was determined not to be so clean, the point of departure was, okay, we're going to clean the site up to quote-unquote zero. The public feels, oh, it should be zero. Well, that's not necessarily realistic, so clean it up to background. And so that was sort of our point of departure, or clean it up to the regulatory level of maximum contaminant level. But realistically, in many cases, that's not going to be possible. And so rather than continue to grind and spin our wheels about how can we get to that background level, taking a risk-based approach allows us to prioritize and set cleanup goals that are more achievable and realistic while still providing that human health and ecological protection.
Thanks.
I don't have a question. I have a comment. I find this very useful, and these are fabulous tools, probably different than anybody else here I've I've completed one very large-scale health risk assessment for Oakland Airport, which took about a year and a half, and I don't even remember how much money. I was just beat up all the time for it. And then initiated health risk assessments for the operation of the Port of Oakland in terms of all the diesel emissions. And so I want to give you kind of my opinion from that experience on, is the standard of 1 in 100,000 a sufficiently conservative standard for cancer? I mean, cancer is very scary. Both my parents died of cancer, and my older daughter had thyroid cancer at 12. She's close to 40 now. Very scary things. So when you actually get in under the hood and you're beginning to look at cancer risk, what you find out is that they're based on the most conservative assumption or the most conservative data about cancer exposure associated with or chemical exposure associated with cancer. And in all cases, the most conservative slope factors are selected. And exposure, you know, the most conservative assumptions, and in terms of the target population, the most conservative. So it probably adds from 1 to 2 orders of magnitude of conservatism. So the 1 in 100,000 on a health risk assessment is more like 1 in 1,000,000 when you really take a look at those cumulative factors. Now, that's still pretty scary, but I think you want to remember that cancer is a very common disease, in part because of exposure and in part because of age. One person out of three gets cancer over their lifetime. So in comparison, the 1 in 1,000,000 to 1 in 10,000,000 is pretty conservative. And at the other extreme of that, there's also some risk of overregulating, because you end up spending money on things that don't really reduce the population's health risk and have adverse consequence. And the example I'll give of that is that when we were dredging the Port of Oakland from 42 feet to 50 feet, we had some material that did not meet the mercury cover wetland criteria in the environmental screening levels. It was fine to go to the ocean. It didn't have to be capped into the ocean. It didn't have direct toxicity. It was just above that. And I went through any number of debates and discussions with the people regulating Montezuma and people concerned about it. The material in question that we buried under 3 feet of cleaner mud was cleaner than the material on the surface of Suisun Marsh throughout because of the historic exposure. So you have to put it in the context that if you're worried about cancer, maybe the best thing to do is not haul too much soil around in diesel-powered trucks. So you have to be careful at the other end of over-regulating to the point where you're actually pushing risk in some other ways. They're great tools, great presentation.
Thank you.
All right, a couple of things. I'm always really impressed and grateful that our region has developed these screening levels. It's a great, great tool. Makes things go not only faster for us, but it also creates a more uniform and predictable sort of level of certainty for the people who are regulated. And I haven't talked to them, but I'm confident that they appreciate that. We do have one outstanding task, though, that's kind of a long-term task on our ESLs, and that's hopefully to get more peer review, and that's one of those things that almost never comes to the top of our list, but I keep wanting to put it on the list, so there you are. Hopefully, at some point, we'll be able to make that a part of our process.
Sure. Stephen Hill again. The ESLs were peer-reviewed back in the early 2000s, and in fact, that effort led to state legislation, SB 32, coincidentally the same as the climate change, AB. And the state was supposed to develop statewide screening levels. built around the ESLs, and for various reasons that didn't happen. But there was a peer review, and several changes were made as a result of that effort. We have not done a subsequent peer review in the formal sense using the contract that the State Board has, because it is a fairly time-consuming right. process, and these are evergreen, so they're changing every year or two. So there's a question of just how often one can do it. Chair Young makes a good point that it is worth revisiting. What we do between scientific peer reviews, though, is we have a group of outsiders, local agencies, other regulators, dischargers, who are on an electronic mailing list. They see updates. They are encouraged to offer suggestions, flag problems, and that's probably the main way in which we find out about things that aren't quite right and fix them. The other thing I would say is we're engaged in a conversation right now with our colleagues at DTSC and Cal EPA about some aspects of the of risk assessment for vapor intrusion, specifically for the chemical TCE. And so that is an outside look at them to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be, that they're being protective in the great majority of cases.
Well, I appreciate hearing about the informal process that we kind of have on an ongoing basis. That sounds like a very forward-looking approach, and I appreciate it. One other comment, and this builds on the question that Mr. Lefkowitz asked about ecological receptors, which I really appreciated. And again, not to go too far into the realm of anecdote, I had the pleasure and opportunity to review the methodology that's used for ecological risk assessments on more than one occasion when I was on the Science Advisory Board at the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. And man, we worked at that, and we got what turned out to be, you know, ultimately a pretty good methodology. I feel pretty good about it, and it's been improved since then. But what we found would happen once we had this great methodology and tried to apply it in the real world was that we'd get down to trying to feed some data on toxicity for particularly non-mammalian species into the methodology, and there was nothing there. You know, there's just no data. So you have no data, no protection, no answers, you know. And this is a problem. Mr. Hill alluded to this, and it's not a problem that we are going to solve, but it is just a characteristic of ecological risk assessment right now that there's precious little data on much of anything except humans and some mammalian species that have been studied for some pesticides. I mean, you know, we all kind of know the drill. But knowing this, I am hoping that we can pay particular attention to the fact that this is a hole in our understanding of what the effects are of these chemicals. And, for example, if we're dealing with a cleanup site in a rural area, there might be amphibian exposure, because we find the amphibians, I mean, they're the ones most at risk. They're crawling around in the stuff, and it absorbs dermally. Even in cases where we might not have to do a full-blown ecological risk assessment, I would just ask that we pay particular attention to the exposure scenarios for amphibians in those situations, and maybe use that to help inform where we put the site on our priority list and whether or not we require interim measures.
And I would say that to a large degree we do that our point of departure is to remove the potential or existing pathway from, say, groundwater to surface water or soil to surface water. That certainly becomes a challenge in wetland areas, and in fact, today's item 5C talked about the work that's been done in the wetlands there adjacent to East Palo Alto, and lots of progress made, but it's not... I mean, the challenge there is to what extent, as you're removing the pathway, then you're impacting the wetlands, and so how do you come up with some some balance there? So I would say, though, that we have been very cognizant of the potential pathway of something that, if a site is very close to the bay, is there a pathway to reach the bay, and can we cut that off? The Point Mulati site's an example of where they had historic, they basically filled in during World War II, filled in an area of the bay to put in oil, waste oil sludge in there. And even though they had put a slurry wall in, we found even below that there was the pathway to get into the bay. So that cleanup included taking all that material out down to a very, you know, extensive depth at some significant cost, and basically to remove the pathway. So I think, you know, this is something that I think our region is far ahead of others of recognizing that, because so many sites can have this pathway to reach ecological receptors, that we need to consider both that pathway, but how do we remove the pathway? And so we always try to say, you know, we're protecting human health and the environment, not just human health.
Yes, Stephen Hill, I'll just add to what Bruce said. It is difficult to do eco-risk assessments for the reasons you stated. One thing that's been helpful occasionally is the use of indicator species and screening levels, which are kind of few and far between. There's something called the effects range medium, effects range low. I think Long is the author of that work that's still being used. It's a crude tool. I can remember back in the late 90s when this board was considering the East Shore Park project, where we used a couple of indicator species, a mouse and a bird, and some work that detailed work that had been done by the U.S. Department of Energy elsewhere in the country to come up with levels for those species, and they were used as indicators for a site here in the Bay Area. So sometimes there are shortcuts that you can do if you want to get something rather than be stuck. So we're still working on that.
Well, we'll all still be working on it by the even after we retire, but good work, folks. I appreciate it very much. This is impressive science work, and reminds us all that we are fundamentally a science agency, and in addition to a very, you know, very smart, street smarts agency.
And I'll
what did
I'll
I
caution,
leave out there?
I'll caution you that when we do the risk management piece, we're going to start off with a quiz on the risk assessment. So hopefully,
you have to study.
Yeah.
Anyway,
thank you, Ms. Fry. Appreciate it.
I do want to call attention to item 7, where we do have one of the staff on the San Francisco Creek Joint Powers Authority complimenting Susan Glendening, who's our staff working on that long-running project, that they're recognizing that we do have some value added in the process moving forward, which is a good thing. And you note that we did send out a letter a few weeks ago to sort of update the Joint Powers Authority of where they are in terms of getting reports to us that we need to approve before they start construction. They're optimistic they can start construction before the wet season. They're starting to run out of clock, but they want to do some things. They already have started doing some utility work, which is essentially outside the footprint of the waters. But we're going to continue to engage on that, and I'm pleased to see that they're recognizing our performance.
Can I add something here? I was at the Energy and Environment Summit down in San Jose about, I think it was last week, at Oracle Stadium, not the stadium, the Oracle buildings, and ran into the new interim CEO of Santa Clara Valley Water District. Mm. And she came to
Norma Camacho.
Yes, Norma Camacho. So she came to me and said, first of all, she said, oh, I'm the interim CEO. And then she said that I think they're looking into the next phase of the project, or they're putting their application in or something like that. I didn't engage that much, didn't want to have that conversation really. I wasn't necessarily sure if I can or not, so I didn't really engage that much. But she mentioned that. So they are looking into the next phase already.
Which would be above Highway 101.
Yes. Above, yes, yeah. in the you know, upstream of the...
Right. And that's they have been talking about moving forward on that. There's a number of moving parts because the water district is taking the lead on some components such as replacing some of the bridges in there, and when they replace the bridges, they're going to expand the or widen the openings there. The city of Palo Alto's taking some of that work on. The Joint Powers Authority has sort of told us, oh, well, we're not doing that, so we're not the ones yet. But it's really all part of the project, and we're trying to remind them that when we issued the certification now over a year ago, that we said we wanted to be part of the process moving forward. So we're trying to remind them of that, that working together early in the process is better than trying to catch up late in the game.
Right. Absolutely.
Yes, it still could get messy, but it's great to have this letter. What a refreshing change from some of the other correspondence that we got.
Something positive. From San Francisco Creek.
How did they resolve their issue with PG&E in that?
They were able to essentially come up with a more beneficial cost share with PG&E, so they're getting more money out of PG&E, right. So for their work. So
we do. Yes, we're all on the same wavelength. Go ahead.
We can do that in open session, and then Tamron says we should do a brief closed session.
Just because I like hanging out with you guys. So under the open session, I'm going to call this correspondence. We have correspondence from the court in Solano County that granted, sustained our demur for the Point Buckler litigation. And what that means is that the AG filed a motion to get rid of the lawsuit, and the lawsuit has now gone away. So it's very good news.
I mean, I no longer named it.
Somebody will find something to sue you over, Bruce, but not this time. So that's it for
open session.
And yes, we'll go ahead and make the closed session announcement, which is we have items to discuss under item 9 on the agenda. The issues of initiating litigation and San Francisco Baykeeper, and this is under Government Code Sections 11126E.
The room's already right. Cleared, isn't it? Are you
adjourning into closed session?
Yes.
Or going into closed session and then coming back and adjourning? The second one.
The second, yeah.
Okay, could you let me know the time? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, let's do 5 minutes, and then this is going to be pretty brief. We're still going to try to get Jim out of here by 11, and everybody else who needs to go. So, yeah, 5 minutes, and then we'll come back.